Okay, well, before we get started into our sermon, I wanted to give you a quick save the date. And this save the date is for Saturday, January 11th. A few weeks ago, I issued a bit of a challenge and encouragement to try to get extended time with God. Okay, just get time alone with Him and make it an extended time, like multiple hours at a time with God, more than just a kind of a typical morning devotional, but to really get with God for an extended time. Well, we wanted to offer maybe a bit of a resource or an encouragement to do that, and that would just be basically starting off next year, 2025, by joining us here in the building to just get some of that time. We just want to open the building up and make most of the building available just to be with God. And we'll offer a little bit of direction and some encouragement, maybe some tools to do that if you've never spent extended time with God. But we just invite you to use that day to do so, whether that's part of the day or most of the day or whatever. I think it'd be great to continue to practice that, of spending big chunks of time with God. And so just remember, January 11th, that'll be happening. All right, well, let's get to our passage. And remember, we are in Matthew chapter 7. We're getting to the end of the Sermon on the Mount. We've been in this resilience series for quite some time, and we're almost done. And we're in the last part of Matthew chapter 7, and we've entered into this section, this final section of the Sermon on the Mount. And this section contains, it's a unit, but it contains several subsections. And Travis laid that out for us last week. And he started us by just breaking it down into these four sections. And really, they all have to do with this decision that Jesus is calling us to. He's spoken through a lot in chapters 5 and 6, and he's ending bringing a strong call, really. A strong call not to straddle, not to be on the fence, not to waver, but he's urging us to make a decision. And so, of course, Travis brought that strong admonition last week when he talked about the two paths or the two gates. There's a narrow gate and there's a wide gate, and he strongly urged us to enter by the narrow gate because that's where life is. And I'm sure that brought conviction to many of us to make sure that we are on that narrow path. But Jesus continued to offer a number of pictures of that decision and of following him and making that decision to be with him, choosing life. And so there are those two paths, but then there are the two trees, the two relationships, and the two foundations. And for these last few weeks of the Sermon on the Mount, we'll just talk through each one of those. And so, of course, we're on the second one today. This is two trees. Now, I will say before we get into it, this one's actually a little bit different than the other three, and we'll see why, but why it's supportive of the other three and why it's going to be helpful. So let's talk about that. First, I'm just going to read the passage for us. I'll have it up here on the screen. It's just a few verses. You can also open your Bibles to your house Bibles to page 812 and follow along and refer back to it. That could be helpful as well. But I'll read these verses. Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You will recognize them by their fruits. Are grapes gathered from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? So every healthy tree bears good fruit, but the diseased tree bears bad fruit. A healthy tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a diseased tree bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus you will recognize them by their fruits. So, this is a little different than these other three subsections here. We're talking about two trees and the fruit that they bear, but specifically we're talking about false prophets. Okay, those who would claim the leading of God, but be speaking falsely. They would make that claim falsely. And And although in this section, Jesus is talking about really this decision that he's calling us to make and the paths that we can walk down, this one is a little different, this section, because he's issuing a warning. He's saying, beware and be careful about who you let guide you down one of those paths. That's going to be really important. So it's not just the decision that he's calling us to make, but he's calling us to be discerning about who guides us down those paths. Now, this topic of false prophets or false teachers, it is a consistent one throughout the Bible. This is brought up many times. We see in the Old Testament prophets warned the people against false prophets, especially Jeremiah and Ezekiel. There was a consistent warning there. And in the New Testament as well, you see several pretty strong warnings about false prophets. I'm going to read one out of 2 Peter chapter 2. It says, "But false prophets also arose among the people, just as there will be false teachers among you who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the master who bought them, bringing upon themselves swift destruction. And many will follow their sensuality, and because of them, the way of truth will be blasphemed. And in their greed, they will exploit you with false words. Their condemnation from long ago is not idle, and their destruction is not asleep." And again, we see this kind of warning in many different places. And we understand that wherever truth was going to be proclaimed, there would also be a likelihood that falsehood would be there as well. And throughout history, there would be people that would use the faith, use religion, use the church for their own ends, and that we should be aware of that. Yeah. So this is an important topic. It doesn't sound very Christmassy, but this is important. And we want to continue just to walk through the end of the Sermon on the Mount and address this too, realizing that this is going to be critical as we make this decision that Jesus calls us to make. And really, by the end, we want to see that this topic does relate. It is kind of Christmassy because it calls us to trust King Jesus. So that's what we're going to talk about this morning. And again, it is probably very pertinent, can be relatable for many of us. You know, I have several books on my bookshelf. They're really good books that really blessed me, that I appreciate much of what is shared in them, but I can't recommend them anymore because they were written by somebody who failed in some significant way. And we've all touched on that. We've all experienced that either from afar or up close. So this is an important topic. That said, we're teaching this morning, and my task is to teach you to scrutinize your teachers. Okay, so my task is to encourage you to evaluate what you hear, and maybe with a bit of a wary, suspicious eye. That doesn't sound like all that appealing of a task, actually. And it wasn't when I first kind of got my mind around it, like to invite you to be suspicious, to beware of those who are teaching you. But I am going to say that this is actually something that I should want to teach, and I want to explain that. And so before we get into this passage and we talk about recognizing false prophets by their fruit, let me make a couple quick comments. First of all, of course, we're not aiming for an overly critical spirit. Okay, we want to become discerning here. We want to, like Jesus said, beware, but we're not aiming for this overly critical spirit. After all, we're balancing this with other truths in the Bible. For example, just earlier in this chapter 7, we were told not to judge. And we see other commands, encouragements not to entertain accusations, say, against an elder unless it's brought by two or three witnesses. We see things like that. And so we are not to have this overly critical spirit. And we do want to be very discerning and probably slow to conclude things about people and to make sure that we have all the understanding that we need. You know, I think this principle in Proverbs 18:17 is such an important one. Such an important one that we all must embrace. It says, the one who states his case first seems right until the other comes and examines him. And so we've got to have that in mind. I think we can hear something, we can perceive something about somebody, but we want to withhold judgment until we have the full story, of course. And so we don't want to create that kind of spirit, besides, especially, because that is much of the spirit of the age. You know, especially in our virtual world, where we can go online and we can see many people, many organizations, we can see articles, books, that are written in an effort to sniff out the wolves. And it can be very tempting to really get swept up in that and come to conclusions that we shouldn't. So that's not what we're aiming for, of course, this morning. But we are aiming for a discernment that every true teacher should value. And so this is why I think I can speak about this confidently, because this is something that every teacher should want. Every teacher that has a genuine faith in Jesus and who is striving, if maybe imperfectly, but striving to proclaim truth, should want to have a church trained to value the right kinds of fruit. Okay, to have their sensitivities sharpened. And to be able to discern what's important, what's not, and how to sift through that. After all, we are drawn to value fruit. Naturally, in our human nature, we are drawn to value fruit that might not be that trustworthy. Okay, we value things that are shiny, polished, and flashy. And if you have a church that's trained to value those kinds of things, then any teacher is just going to constantly feel this pressure to perform in order to meet those kinds of expectations. And it's going to be crushing because it's impossible. So, of course, any true teacher should want a church that has had their discernment shaped and trained and exercised in order to look for the right things. And not to create standards that are impossible to attain. So, with that in mind, let's get into it. And remember, the gist of this is that there are false prophets, and you will recognize them by their fruits. And so we want to try to discuss this morning what is the fruit that we're looking for or not looking for, what should we beware of, what is validating. We're going to look at those kinds of fruits. But, again, a few other preliminary comments before we get to the fruit. I just want to make some general comments or observations about this passage and what we learn from it. Number one, it's not always immediately obvious that a wolf is a wolf. Of course, the passage says that the wolves come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. And so they don't look like wolves. Of course, they look like sheep from a distance. Okay, on the surface, things are going to look pretty good. There's going to be a real subtlety here. They look like sheep. Okay, we could also go to 2 Corinthians chapter 11. For such men are false prophets, deceitful workmen, disguising themselves as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. So it is no surprise if his servants also disguise themselves as servants of righteousness. Their end will correspond to their deeds. And so, of course, Satan disguises himself as a servant of righteousness, an angel of light, and so his work is going to be very subtle, and it may look very good on the outside. But there still is a stark difference in fruit. So a healthy tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a diseased tree bear good fruit. There will be an obvious outcome, okay, that will eventually be expressed. Although it's subtle, it's not easily seen on the surface, it will bear itself out eventually. 2 Timothy 3:8-9 says, just as Jannes and Jambres opposed Moses, so these men also oppose the truth, men corrupted in mind and disqualified regarding the faith. But they will not get very far, for their folly will be plain to all, as was that of those two men. Okay, eventually, it's going to play itself out. So it is going to be subtle, but we still will be able to tell. That's the idea. And finally, both the teaching and the teacher are important. So, of course, we're looking at the content of the teaching and the fruit of that content, and we're also looking at the life of the teacher. Okay, so both are important. With those things in mind, we do want to train ourselves to recognize by fruit. And so we're going to ask three questions. What fruit should we not use in our evaluation? Number two, what bad fruit should we beware of? And three, what good fruit should we look for? So number one, what fruit should we not use in our evaluation? Well, I kind of alluded to this earlier, but these kinds of things, I would say we want to be careful about putting too much stock in. Things like these, the size of the crowd that a person draws, or the pace of the growth of that crowd, or the eloquence or charisma with which a teacher speaks. Now, these things are not bad. This isn't bad fruit. This could be very good. After all, in the book of Acts, we see explosive growth, large crowds. The early church just took off and multiplied by the thousands. It was remarkable. And when we think of eloquence or charisma, Jesus himself obviously was compelling. And he could speak in such a way that people could sit there and listen to him for 3 straight days without food. And they spoke of him as one who spoke with authority, and that nobody ever spoke like him. And so these things are not bad. They're just not that trustworthy. They're not the kinds of fruit that we want to prioritize as we try to evaluate. After all, we could say these things. Jeremiah preached for decades and saw almost no response. Paul's life ended with many people abandoning him and nobody standing with him in his first defense. Jesus had many disciples leave at one point after hard teaching in John 6:66, and only 120 people were still following him shortly after his ascension. So these weren't huge crowds. This wasn't explosive fruit necessarily. It was healthy fruit, but it was not explosive in terms of numbers. And so we have to be careful to judge on those types of things. We could consider eloquence and charisma. Remember, Moses was slow of speech and of tongue. He didn't think he could speak. He said, God, don't send me. I can't speak to these people. And secondly, it was said of Paul that his letters are weighty and strong, but his bodily presence is weak and his speech of no account. Seems like he wasn't that powerful. And we think of Paul as a pretty powerful communicator. But this is how he was described by the Corinthians. And he himself said in 1 Corinthians 2, when he came to them, he didn't come with eloquence. He didn't come to them with plausible words of wisdom, but in fear and in trembling. And so eloquence and charisma are not trustworthy fruits. And we should be careful not to put too much into them. So next, what bad fruit should we beware of? Well, there are lots of things here that we could point to. And I could do that in a lot of different ways. First of all, we could just take a look at, say, 1 Timothy 3 or Titus 1, where qualifications are given for elders or for leadership in the church. And many of those qualifications are negative ones, like an elder should not be arrogant or quick-tempered and things like that. And so we could look at those and say, okay, those are the things that are not becoming for a leader, and we should beware of those. We could also go to specific passages like 2 Peter 2 or like the book of Jude that describe false prophets and false teachers pretty clearly. And we could pull some things out of there. Well, I tried to comb through those kinds of passages and just see, were there things that seemed to bubble up? And again, there are lots of things that I could reference. I just want to give you three that stood out to me in combing through some of those passages. What bad fruit should we beware of? Number one, neglecting to preach the whole Jesus. Okay, the whole Jesus. You see several passages that seem to speak about warning us about those who deny the Lord Jesus in some way. So for example, 1 John 2:22 and 23, who is the liar but he who denies that Jesus is the Christ? This is the Antichrist, he who denies the Father and the Son. Or 2 Peter 1, but false prophets also arose among the people, just as there will be false teachers among you who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the master who bought them. And so there's denying the lordship, the messiahship of Jesus, but I think it's also maybe shaving off some of the edges of Jesus. Jesus is so complex and robust, sometimes paradoxical. It is easy to just cut off pieces of who he is, to not preach a whole Jesus, to not preach both his grace and his truth, or his justice and his mercy, or his deity and his humanity, but to just shave off those rough edges, make him a little more able to, or containable. And so we should watch if people are tampering with the full person of Jesus. Of course, that's going to be a sign that somebody maybe speaking falsely. Secondly, I'm just going to say manipulative gain. When you go through some of these passages that describe false prophets, you'll see certain words and phrases. One of those words is going to be greed. Often they're spoken of as just simply being greedy. But you'll see other phrases, like in 2 Peter 2, verse 15, that they loved gain from wrongdoing. Or in Jude 16, they showed favoritism to gain advantage. And I think I just got the sense that there's this posturing, this manipulation, where people are trying to gain advantage. They're trying to work things in order to advance their position, in order to gain that favor. And you just see them willing to take those steps, and it's like they're always trying to climb a ladder, perhaps, or just get themselves in a little higher position. And so you see that quite a bit. And conversely, somebody that's trustworthy may be willing to give up certain positions. You don't see them constantly posturing and maneuvering. Thirdly, I would just say quarrelsomeness. It's quarrelsomeness. We could go to one of those passages in 1 Timothy 3 that describe leadership and the qualifications of leadership. One of those is just not to be quarrelsome. But also, other passages that are describing false teachers, you see words like this: they're grumblers, they're malcontents, they cause divisions. In 2 Timothy 2, it says, but avoid irreverent babble, for it will lead people into more and more ungodliness, and their talk will spread like gangrene among them. Then he calls out a couple guys, Hymenaeus and Philetus. And it just seems like there were people that were speaking things that just created some contention and disunity and quarreling. And I think that's what you pick up as you see these kinds of descriptions. And so these are some markers, some of that bad fruit that I think we are to beware of: neglecting to preach the whole Jesus, manipulative gain, and quarrelsomeness. But what about the good fruit that we should look for? Let me also give you three characteristics of good fruit. First of all, in contrast to what I just shared about the preaching the whole Jesus, the willingness to speak the whole counsel of God, yet without a contentious spirit. So I said not to be quarrelsome. They shouldn't be quarrelsome. So there's not this contention that is produced, but there is this willingness to speak the whole counsel of God. In Jeremiah warns against those who only spoke peace. He says, for from the least to the greatest of them, everyone is greedy for unjust gain, and from prophet to priest, everyone deals falsely. They have healed the wound of my people lightly, saying, peace, peace, when there is no peace. So this was a tendency of a false prophet to say, no, it's going to be just fine, peace, peace, when in reality there was a whole counsel of God that included a judgment and there were certain consequences. 2 Timothy 4, 3 through 4 says, for the time is coming when people will not endure sound teaching, but having itching ears, they will accumulate for themselves teachers to suit their own passions and will turn away from listening to the truth and wander off into myths. So there's a tendency of people to gather teachers, false teachers, that tickle their ears, okay, that speak maybe what feels nice, that feels pleasant, and to speak those kinds of things. And so that's something to watch out for. Somebody that is maybe unwilling to say hard things or that full counsel. Last week, Travis shared some hard things. You know, there was a strong admonition there, but he did it, I think, without a contentious spirit. And I think there's a trustworthiness in that, to share hard truth, but to do it very graciously and lovingly. Okay, secondly, there's a positive effect on an inner circle. And here's what I mean by that. I think it is again, very easy for us to value or to see as very important the effect that someone has on the crowd. Okay, what kind of effect do they have on large groups of people? But I think the Bible points us to evaluating what kind of effect they have on a small group of people, maybe people that are close to them. So, for example, in 1 Timothy 3, there's this requirement for eldership. He must manage his own household well, with all dignity, keeping his children submissive. For if someone does not know how to manage his own household, how will he care for God's church? And it is very easy to, again, value the effect on the crowd. And if somebody is extraordinarily gifted in affecting the crowd, to give that a lot of merit. But the Bible draws us back and says, no, there's a prerequisite there. First, that someone in leadership must be able to care for and shepherd a small group of people and see a positive effect there. And so in looking to evaluate good fruit in say, teachers, people who are proclaiming the word of God, you might first look at, okay, what's happening? What's happening in their home? What's happening in that close inner circle, the people that they seem to touch most nearly? What's going on there? And we've got to train ourselves to look there to see if that's trustworthy. Now, speaking of family, we're just talking about the effect of the family, what's going on in the home. I want to take a little bit of a diversion here, speaking of family, because today is my son's 18th birthday, okay? And I got a picture of him right here. And he's got his bling there wrapped around his head, and he's wearing his handsome shirt. And so I just wanted to encourage you guys to, when you see him, say, happy birthday, handsome, okay? I think you'd really, really appreciate that. No, I feel like, you know, this is kind of a once-in-a-lifetime thing, like to be preaching on a Sunday when one of your children turns 18, like it would be wrong for me not to embarrass him there, I think. All right. Actually, it's also Case Ferguson's birthday too, so you can tell him happy birthday, maybe not the handsome part, but happy birthday. All right, back to the topic at hand. Again, we're evaluating a close inner circle. I think that's what's most trustworthy. What's the effect that somebody has on that smaller group, not just on the crowd? And thirdly, the willingness to endure struggle and reveal weakness. 2 Corinthians 11:30 says, if I must boast, I will boast of the things that show my weakness. And this is in a long section where Paul is describing weaknesses and different persecutions that he had to endure and hard things in his life. Well, it was hard. And this is in the middle of a defense of his ministry. Okay, he's defending himself to those that were accusing him, and he points to his weaknesses and the things that he endured. Not to his amazing gifting, and he had amazing gifting, but he referenced his weaknesses. And again, I think that's just something that we can look for. How does somebody respond to trials and weakness, and how does somebody endure? And what do they reference as giving credibility? Okay, that's just another of those fruits. Okay, with those things said, and I went through a lot of that pretty quickly, but with those said, I did want to take a little bit of a diversion again and talk about just practically a couple things that we do here at Some of You. I think this is important. I think this is a good opportunity to describe some of what we could call our church government here. And some of the steps that we take that we believe offers a health and a protection, both to the church and to pastors. Okay? And so I'm just going to highlight two features of our church government here. And these are features that are a little unusual. That's why I want to reference them tonight or today. They're a little unusual. They're not unique. There are actually several other churches that have a similar structure right here in town. But they are a little unusual, and so I wanted to highlight them. Number one, at Some of You, pastors are generally recognized from within the church after an extended observation of character. Okay, that is how we have traditionally done things, is that we have recognized a pastor after typically a pretty long period of him ministering within the church and maybe assuming more and more responsibilities and testing and vetting that along the way and getting to know the character and the fruit. And rather than simply trying to recruit the best and the brightest from elsewhere, seeing pastors raised up from within the church. And we believe that there's a real health there, that it allows a church to get to know a potential pastor and for that potential pastor to get to know the church and to live life with the church. And so that's something that we do. But again, we feel like there can be a confidence there because there is that vetting process. Now, nothing's foolproof. Of course, any one of us can turn from a path that we are on. And we can begin to struggle. And that certainly can happen. But we try to give a lot of runway there and a lot of period of time for that kind of observation. Secondly, as pastors, we operate in a relatively flat plurality. Again, this is a little unusual in that we have four pastors here, but we actually don't have a senior pastor. And we distribute our teaching fairly evenly. We distribute a lot of our tasks as evenly as we can. Of course, there's gifting, and we try to set each one of us up to operate in our wheelhouses. But in general, we try to spread out that responsibility and feel like there's a health there as well. Now, this, again, is not unique, but is a little unusual. And it's unusual because it's inefficient. It's just inefficient to have four guys trying to make decisions as one. Now, I will say honestly, it's not impossible. And I think we do it. And I think because there's a real common value of reaching a consensus, we do labor through that and we do come to decisions and we take action, but it is slower. However, what we sacrifice in efficiency, I do believe we can gain in health, you know, as we do distribute the load. I think it's healthy both for the church and for the pastor. So for the church, I think it is healthy to hear regularly several different perspectives. Now, I know everybody has their favorites, but I think it's good to not hear your favorite every week. Okay, I think it's good to get a variety of different angles. Now, of course, there's going to be a lot of commonality. We still share key doctrines in common, obviously. But we're all going to have a different bent and a different way of presenting things, and I think that's a good thing for the church. I think it's good for the church to watch a pastoral team work as a body. I also think it's protective for the pastor, too. I'm unconvinced that individuals are designed to carry most of the burden of the church on their individual shoulders. I think that's easy. It's very easy to burn out in that kind of situation, and many do. And so we believe that it's good, healthy, protective for both the church and the pastor. So that's just a little bit of some of the things that we do here related to this topic. But let me summarize a few things now. So in conclusion, let me just wrap up with a few final points. Number one, Jesus' warning should draw us more deeply into the church. Okay, I believe this, even into the local church here. When we look at what I think is good quality fruit, those are generally, it's fruit that you have to be kind of close to the teacher to observe. Okay, the teacher has to be accessible. Now, we live in an age where we have great access to lots and lots of teachers, and we should use that access. And I often recommend books and teachings for other people to read or listen to, because they're so good and refreshing and can explain things better than I can. And there are so many teachers out there that you have access to in your pocket right now that are way better than any of the four of us here. Okay, you have access to them, but you don't have access to their lives. And I think there's a real value there in certainly accessing all of those resources that we have. That's a huge gift to the modern church. But to really make your bread and butter in a community that you do have access and insight into. And so I think understanding some of this can draw our hearts in and together, and that's a good thing. Number two, resilience is cultivated when we train ourselves to value the right qualities in a teacher. So that's a lot of what I've been trying to describe today. We're aiming for resilience throughout this entire series. But it is cultivated when we look for the right fruit. Okay, when we trust things that are trustworthy, then it creates this solid strength. And so we should train ourselves in these things. And if we're looking to walk down the right path, we want to make sure that we are guided by those who reveal things that are trustworthy. And that creates a resilience. And then finally, I have not really gone into this yet, but I did want to leave us with this point. And as I'm doing so, band, you can go ahead and come on back up. But the final point is that Jesus builds and shepherds the church. When we're talking about false teachers and making or distinguishing between good and bad fruit, it can be, I feel like it can be just kind of disheartening, or it can feel like a big struggle, and it can be confusing. God does give us resources to make those kind of distinctions, and I think to evaluate fruit rightly, but mostly he gives us himself. And you know, Jesus told Peter, he says, "I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." And he was building his church not on Peter the person, but on what Peter had just proclaimed, proclaiming that Jesus was the Christ. And this man who made this statement, Jesus said, "We're going to build our church here. I'm going to build my church right here." And he promised that, and Jesus will continue to build his church, and he is king, and he is trustworthy. And so as we're just sorting through all of this and wondering what's trustworthy and what's not, I think it's really helpful just to understand Jesus loves his church, and Jesus will continue to build it, and he is working for it, and he will not let his church crumble. Okay, that he can be trusted, and we can come to him in faith, and we know that he is king. And the king rules well his subjects, and he's going to carry them on to the end.